Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Cultimatum fans, before we dive into today's episode, we need a tiny favor from each of you.
That's right. If you love what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple and Spotify.
Your support helps us to reach new listeners and bring more awareness and attention to these important topics.
So tap that star rating, drop a quick review, and help us spread the word. It really does make a difference.
Thank you so much for tuning in and for your amazing support. We truly appreciate each and every one of you. Now let's get started with the show.
Here we go. Welcome to Cultimatum, the culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew. And with me today is my co-host Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. Today we are honored to have Brandon Salo, a writer, musician, craftsman, teacher, and voice actor who has built a life shaped by creativity and resilience. Brandon is currently living in Portugal. He is a survivor of the House of Yahweh, the same cult that I escaped at age 20. When I left, Brandon was just 11 years old, and he remained in the cult with his family for several more years. His book, Poison into Medicine, My Life in a Doomsday Cult, chronicles his journey through indoctrination, survival, and transformation. Today, he's here to share his story, insights, and how he turned his past into something meaningful. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome, Brandon. And Brandon is joining us all the way from Portugal.
Yes.
An overseas invite. So, Brandon, where would you like to start?
Well, I guess like all stories, let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
So I was born in Michigan, 1985. He married my mother shortly after that. And they got divorced when I was four. My father had an interest in religion. And so we were going from church to church, visiting different groups, various Christian groups. I was baptized as a Lutheran. And when I was four, my father, unfortunately, had to face the divorce from my mother that my mother instigated. She had an affair, and she started the divorce and got full custody of me and then took me away from my father. And needless to say, my father was in a very dark place emotionally. And his financial life was also disrupted. So around this time, my father was at a cafe in Ishpeming, Michigan, and he was reading a National Geographic article about a tithe receipt that was found in, I believe it was Egypt. And it had an inscription on this, I guess, little piece of clay, and it said Yahweh in Aramaic. And shortly after that, he came across a brochure from one of the only members in the Upper Peninsula named Gary Matala. And the brochure said the creator has a name. So this was a bit synchronistic for my father, but he took that as a sign. And that was what the cult members referred to as a calling. So I was about 4 years old during all of this, and he started to visit the local group in Wisconsin. It was a larger branch near Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And so when I was about 5 years old, that's when I started going with him. I should add that my mother had traits of clinical narcissism, and she was quite toxic emotionally, and I recognized this at the age of about 3 years old when I first witnessed my parents fighting. And so my father, despite the fact that he was easily manipulated by this cult, the House of Yahweh, he was a very caring father. And I knew that, I sensed that the emotional stability would, you know, would be there more with my father than with my mother. So I just had a natural tendency to want to be with my father from a young age. So I'm talking about this mostly because I had the unusual case of going to public schools during my time in the cult. And most cult members at a young age, they were either homeschooled or I guess some of them didn't go to school. But it was somewhat unusual for cult members to go all the way through public school and graduate. So I started participating at the age of, we'll just say about six. And when I first got to the feast, the first feast, I believe, was in 1991 or 92. I think it was maybe Tabernacles, which would have been in the early fall. And, you know, people were really friendly at the cult, and it didn't really seem too unusual. But one thing I should mention that when I first visited the people in Manitowoc for our Sabbath gatherings was the tendency for love bombing is what they call it. And, you know, they're giving you a lot of attention, a lot of positivity, a lot of welcoming, a lot of interest. And I'm not really sure that people were conscious about this. I think it was practiced like in a, you know, kind of like a tradition, welcome the new people. Probably, you know, the people who were running it, probably particularly the Heimermans, you know, was probably a little bit more conscious, at least with him. David Heimerman, one of the longstanding elders from Wisconsin that's still a part of the cult now. But other than that, I just think it was a typical practice. And then shortly after, once you become accustomed to, you know, to the atmosphere, that's when they start telling you what you can eat, what you can't eat, what you can say, what you can't say. And so that was a little unusual at first. But other than that, it was pretty friendly in the early 90s. And then as things evolved, they started to get a little bit more fundamental, more strict.
Can I jump in, Brandon?
Absolutely.
I'm a little curious. So at four, that's when your parents divorced and your mom got custody of you. Your dad joined the House of Yahweh.
Correct.
Did your mom and dad live close to each other, or how did you get to the House of Yahweh with your dad? Were you there on weekends? Or I'm just trying to think, if mom had custody of you, she would raise you in her belief system, or so they must have had a conversation at some point.
Yeah, I can clarify this a little bit. So I generally spent every other weekend with my father, and definitely once a month. Sometimes it was most weekends, but my mother moved around a lot. So when I was about five, we had moved to Green Bay. We moved to a few different places in Green Bay. We moved from Green Bay to Des Moines, Iowa. We lived in a couple places there. And then from Des Moines, Iowa, we moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we lived in a few places there. But I always begged to live with my father. And my father would always make the effort to come and pick me up. He would drive all the way to Green Bay or Des Moines or Milwaukee and pick me up. So I think it was in the early 90s when we were talking about, yeah, it must have been around 95 when the House of Yahweh was talking about the members having to go to Israel for the end times. And so, I was about eight. This was probably, this is probably 94-ish, 93, 94-ish. That was going on in the cult, but my mother took me to a doctor. And I guess to get a physical, and I didn't want the doctor touching me. And so I was really resistant to the doctor, you know, touching my genital area. Standard physical thing, but it was just so out of the blue for me. I felt really uncomfortable with it. And so that prompted my mother to go to the courts. And apparently it was communicated to somebody that I was exhibiting signs of being molested. Which I never was, thankfully. So there was that. And then, you see, I was supposed to go live with my father when I was about nine for the fourth grade. And I did actually go to move with him. But then the police came and took me away. I guess my mother had some kind of court order to continue custody. And so I lived with her for another year. And that in itself was quite traumatic. So, you know, I had a real longing to live with my father. And despite the evolution of, you know, the House of Yahweh at that time, it really wasn't something on my radar because I was more shocked by what was happening with the family. And I guess things really didn't start to evolve quickly until after that happened. And my father always asked the cult leaders, should we take him out of public school? And they said, no, we don't want to have issues with his mother.
Are you an only child?
Between my mother and father, I am. But I do have half siblings on both sides.
Okay. And right. So your dad fathered more children or your mom?
Both. My father had one other child before me, and my mother had two other children before her.
They involved in any of this as well? Were they part of the House of Yahweh?
No, they had no idea what my experience was really like until I wrote the book.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. That was the main reason of writing the book, was for my parents to understand my side of the story and for my siblings and the rest of my family to know what it was that I had gone through.
So your dad brought you to the House of Yahweh, but not the other two siblings. Well,
correct.
I guess one was your mother, so he didn't have any
contact.
Well,
two on my mother's side, but yeah, no. My half-sister on my father's side, she came to Texas once, but she didn't really get involved with the House of Yahweh.
So you were the lucky one to get to the House of Yahweh. Go ahead, Melody. I'm sorry.
I have a quick question. Brent, did your dad have some type of special permission or maybe some understanding between him and your mother that he was able to bring you to the feast down in Texas?
Yeah, that was my question, really.
I mean, I guess so. You know, like, the House of Yahweh, you know, legally kind of falls in this category of just, you know, just a religion. It just because it's unusual doesn't make it, you know, illegal. So it would make it really complex for a mother to say, like, you can't do this because of infringement on freedom of belief or freedom of religion. So in 1995-ish, around that time, this is when I would say that the rules started to get more strict. It was around this time that polygamy was introduced and accepted. It was around this time that I would say the women's lives and girls' lives in the House of Yahweh started to get very miserable. What was probably most noticeable at first was the uncleanliness characteristic. You know, women were considered unclean when they were on their period. And so anytime a woman was on her period, they had to carry around a placemat and put that down to sit on it. You know, if it was like a picnic table or a bench in the sanctuary. And then they had to leave a little note saying that it was unclean until sunset. Like, I remember like the first time when this rule or law was implemented, I remember going to a picnic table and there was a placemat on the bench. And then there was like a stack of shoeboxes or something, and I slid the shoeboxes aside and sat down, and people are like, oh, you're unclean until sunset now. I was like, huh? It just seemed a little, you know, silly looking back.
Silly. It's ridiculous.
It's insane. Yeah. Well, at the time it was just, you know, I was, you know, 10 years old. I guess, you know, these are the rules, but looking back, it's just absolutely insane. That things really started to spiral. I guess I feel bottlenecked with all of the things that I could say, but feel free to ask me questions. Do you have any other questions or should I continue?
As usual, I'm flabbergasted at how these cults come up with these rules, or, you know, a woman's menstrual cycle is so part of the natural biology of human that's there so she can reproduce. And to make it dirty or unclean, or to call a woman out on that,
in terms of, so for two things here, this is how it benefited the House of Yahweh. For one, you know, it diminishes the self-value of the individuals, in this case, the female.
Absolutely.
And so it makes them easier to control because they have this over their head, this subconscious acknowledgement that they are, you know, a lesser being. And so they're more inclined to obey and follow instructions. Now, the other benefit to the House of Yahweh, and this goes to this like pyramidal structure of the cult, the hierarchy, is that the very few people at the top, the men, but a very few percentage of the men, they had the sexual access to the women. And so these were the men that had many, 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 many wives. So we think of the House of Yahweh as a polygamous cult, and it is, but that does not mean that the majority of the men have multiple wives. In fact, it's the contrary. It's a very few, it's a very small percentage. I could be corrected, but as far as I understand, that is the situation. It's a relatively small percentage of the men. The higher position of the men, the more wives they could have. It allows them to have the excuse so that when one wife is on her period, then, you know, he can go spend time with the other wives, whatever.
Despicable. It's just despicable.
I agree with Brandon 100% about all of this, but I'm going to add in there, and Brandon was actually a victim of this, I'm going to say, is that essentially these older men that had the access to the women, or the, I'm going to say young girls, because obviously they were really going after mostly the young girls. They conscious or unconscious, I'm not sure, but there was somewhat of a goal to use the young men or boys for free labor or whatever they may have, tithes, whatever they may have needed them for, but they essentially were never going to really get wives because all of the young girls were going to go to the older men. And so essentially they were fine with running off the young men and letting them figure their own lives out. I mean, after they used them up, so to speak, they were disposable. And they were okay with the young men leaving the group because they didn't like the competition. That's Brandon, I would like your perspective on my perspective, just to hear what your thoughts are on all that.
I'll double down on that. Were you forced to work? But answer Melody's question first, and then I'm just curious.
So the men, the boys, if you sat down with your elders, we had counselors, two elders that would tell us what to do. You know, they basically told us that the most important thing to do in the House of Yahweh was to pay your tithes, right? First tithe, second tithe, third tithe. And I suppose if you did that, you made a lot of money and you showed a particular type of allegiance to, you know, to the top five people in this group, that they might give you a position. But in general, that's just not what happened. So the boys, yeah, we were just told to work and make money and pay our tithes. Or if we were at the cult, I mean, everybody was told to work, not just the men. I mean, the women were, you know, told to work in the kitchens, in the stores, whatever it might be. But as soon as we got to Texas, we would start working immediately. And that was one of the mottos, work, work, work. So my father was a hard worker and he just liked to work. And I think that was one of the things that he particularly liked about the group is that, you know, they just, you know, they valued people working. You know, they say you're working for, you know, like the benefit of, you know, let's say Yahweh or God or the benefit of everybody in the world. But really, we were just, you know, helping Israel Hawkins build his wealth up into the who knows how many millions.
What kind of work?
A lot of it was spent hauling buckets of food storage. You know, there are massive semi-tractor trailers that are filled with food storage on the compound. So we were moving that a lot. We were building signs, building infrastructure. When I was there, we were building Quonset huts. Just, you know, any kind of manual labor you can really imagine if you were skilled enough to do it. You know, they would have you doing it, electrical work or plumbing. I wasn't skilled to do that, but more manual labor stuff when I was, you know, 14 years old, that was normal.
I have read Brandon's book and there's some specific things I would like Brandon to talk about. I would like Brandon
Feel
to talk
free.
About. Yeah. I would like to, you to tell the story of when you actually did have a girl that you liked that you thought you were going to be able to marry. Could you share that part of your story?
Yeah, I have the book right here, and I want to remember. Do you know the name that I used offhand? I actually can't really remember that right now.
Oh, gosh.
Do you remember the name of her that I used in the book?
I'm trying to remember.
I apologize.
You know what? I can't either.
I think it started with an S. I don't think it was Sandra, though.
Sarah, maybe?
Samantha.
It was Samantha.
Samantha. There Samantha. Was Samantha. Yeah. Obviously, it's a pseudonym. So when I was about 15, 16 years old, this was right after the time where they had the sanctuary separated into two. So women on one side, men on the other side. Women are wearing burqas. This was because, you know, the men didn't want the women to know who else they were married to. So not only could men have wives, men didn't have to tell their current wives who they were married to, if they were getting married to another woman, and so forth. Right? And certainly the leader of the cult didn't want anybody knowing his business. So my father came up to me once and said, hey, you know, this girl, Samantha, you know, she's interested in talking to you. And this is a really rare thing. You know, you should accept, her interest and, you know, talk to her. And so how the process went was, you know, she went to her father went to the elders went to my father's elders, and then my father went to me. And so we started communicating, and basically this was us communicating through a barricade where the elders' wives would be sitting on her side. I couldn't see them. And then the elder, one or two elders would be sitting on my side, and that's how we would talk. Right? Great way to get to know somebody. And so this kind of went on for about a couple years, I guess, maybe about a year and a half. And then Jeff Heimerman called me one Sunday morning and said, Nehemiah, that was my Hebrew name, you are no longer able to speak to Samantha. Your communication is finished and you will no longer be talking to her. And I just said, okay. I mean, I didn't really have an emotional attachment to her. I mean, I knew her father. I liked her father. I really respected him. And, you know, she was a very sweet girl. It's just we could only get to know each other so well. And so about a few months later after that, I found out that, you know, Yisrael Hawkins married her. And I thought to myself, like, well, I mean, at that time, I didn't really care that much. But I thought to myself, and then after I found out that he hadn't asked for permission to her father, I was a little bit disgruntled.
Let me jump in for a second. Because when you had mentioned that your father came to you and said that there was a young lady that was interested in you, I thought that would be completely against what the policy was. Just like earlier, Melody was talking about all the young women were saved for the elders. And so I thought that from the beginning, why would they allow you to do that when she was probably being groomed for an elder? And of course, Yisrael Hawkins, when you said that, I'm not surprised. So
I could see that as like a psychological experiment or as like a carrot on a stick, you know, give them a taste of something, let them dream, you know, maybe he'll be more productive.
Absurd. It's absurd. Yep. Okay.
So, and you know, this is kind of leading up to the situation that where I decided that I had had enough. And it was the Seder feast or the Seder gathering for the Feast of Passover. And I had an opportunity to see Yisrael face to face. And so, I need to back up here. I'm sorry. When her father approached Yisrael Hawkins and said, why didn't you ask me for permission to talk to my daughter? Because this was the tradition that everybody else was supposed to follow. We just figured that, you know, Yisrael Hawkins would do this out of respect, but instead he said, I don't have to ask you for permission. I'm your king. And so I was perturbed by that. And so anyway, I go to see him face to face and I say, Yisrael Hawkins, congratulations on your marriage with Samantha. And I didn't think that he heard me. And so I said it again and I said it a little bit louder. And I could tell that he heard me, but he wouldn't look me in the eye. And so I went and told my father what I did. A couple days later, Jeff Heimerman came to me and said, Brandon, you have no right to talk to Yisrael like that. What he does is none of your business. You had no right to say anything to him about that.
Was there something in your tone, how you said it? Because you simply congratulated him. Or was it a sarcastic tone?
So my father told him, so I don't think the tone had anything to do with it. It just had to do with this, like, you know, you can't talk to anybody like him about his personal life. You can't talk to our king about our personal life.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so
Brandon was not supposed to know. Brandon was not supposed to have this. It was a secret. He was not even supposed to know this had happened.
And so, you know, we're sitting like the far end of the compound, standing on the far end of the compound. And he's, you know, telling me, he says, Brandon, he's our king. Whatever he says goes. He cannot sin. Like, we just have to do what he says in order to make it through these end times. And I just said, you know, Jeff, thank you. That's what I really needed to hear. And that was, you know, the final straw that broke the camel's back. And so then I just kind of pretended to go with the flow until I got back home. And when I got back home, I just said to my dad, you know, I'm not going back. And he didn't really know how to react to it. So he called his counselor, who was my counselor's father. He called David Heimerman. And David Heimerman said, you know, kick that asshole out of the house right now. And
how old were you at that point?
I was 18. This was a few months before I graduated high school. But I, you know, I just already had a backpack ready to go. So I grabbed the backpack and left.
Good for you.
I mean, if you don't have any other questions, perhaps I'd like to speed up a little bit into the future.
Yeah, and talk go. About
some. So, you know, I went to university. I guess I kind of learned some things in university, in my 6 years of university, that I really didn't learn in public school. You could imagine it was really awkward being a part of a cult. And then also, you know, I grew up having dual personalities in a way. So I, you know, I've written this book, and, you know, part of the book was kind of sorting out the complexity of my relationship with my mother, because she was a very complex and, you know, a pretty toxic person. And I got to this point where I just really didn't want to have resentment anymore. And I wanted to, you know, tell my story in a way that I just thought was fair and honest, but not in a way that was like pointing the finger and putting blame on anybody. And so, you know, I just didn't want to have resentment for my father, and I didn't want to have resentment for my mother. Now, I was living in Albany, New York. I had moved there from Montreal, and I had struggled with depression and well, I'll just leave it at that. I struggled with depression and anxiety. But by the time I was living in Albany, New York, I was adopted into this family, which I write about. And I felt really safe, and really put me in the position to start writing. And this was shortly after I saw my father for the last time. I drove to Michigan in November of 2014, and I had a heartfelt, hard conversation with my father in front of the family, in front of his sisters, you know, my cousins, his nephews, and his brother-in-law. And the discussion was about his wife, my stepmother, who died in the House of Yahweh. All women had it hard in the House of Yahweh, and the women that are still there certainly, without a doubt, have it hard. But when you get sick in the House of Yahweh, it's because you're sinning. And when you get cancer, it's because it's your fault. So my stepmother had cancer, and, you know, she didn't want to go get treatment from the hospital. And of course, you know, we have all sorts of cures and holistic treatments in the House of Yahweh, everything from, you know, drinking potent salt water to, I don't know, colloidal silver in my stepmother's case. But when my stepmother was dying, and I knew this, and I didn't have to be told this, but this is what I told my father. I said, for Linda to be begging for forgiveness as she's dying is not something that anybody should have to do. And that's when my father really struggled to hold back his tears in front of the family. And so a couple days later, you know, we hugged and he said goodbye. He was moving to Texas. And when he moved to Texas, he started to be kind of secretive about what was going on, and I wanted to really talk to him about the things that were going on. He was reaching out to my sister and I more, and I remember mentioning to him, like, Dad, I don't want to go travel across Europe and find out that you're in a box. And so I left New York in February. I'd spent time in Sweden and Finland visiting family there, and I was in Germany for a day, and then I got to Spain, and I guess it was April 18th that, you know, that he was found dead. He was found dead hanging in a shed right next to the compound, right next to the gates. I'm not sure what details they are. Let me say it like this. You know, I get to Spain, and, you know, I was really tired. I sleep. You know, I wake up. I go to customs. I was planning a cycling trip across Spain, and you know, I go to customs, I get my bike, I build my bike in customs, I get it back, feeling really good. I go out, socialize a bit, and then, you know, I go to sleep. And in the middle of the night, I felt something touch my foot, and I just jump out of bed. I'm in a hostel room, but it's empty. There's nobody there. So I look around and I go back to sleep. That was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And at about 7 o'clock, I wake up and I see that I have all these missed calls, 7 a.m. Madrid time. And I knew what happened. And so I immediately called my aunt, who passed away not too long ago from cancer, sadly. You know, and she told me what happened and what the story was. And we're both crying on the phone. And so I call the sheriff, and the first thing I ask the sheriff is, did you ask them if you were the first people they called? And he kind of said calmly with a southern accent, well, I didn't think to ask them that. And I said, well, you need to ask them if you were the first people that he called, that they called. And so what actually happened was my father's body was found, right? Apparently, he was working on a project with somebody, and that person stepped away for a certain period of time. And when the person came back, they found my father's body hanging. And then so the person that found him called the local elder in the area, which is David Heimerman. And David Heimerman then called Yisrael Hawkins. And then Yisrael Hawkins got back to David Heimerman. And then David Heimerman came back to the guy who found him and said, check if there's a pulse, right? And I'm sure by this time you could smell the urine in his jeans. So after they checked his pulse and they decided that he was dead, that's when they called the authorities and the ambulance. And then within probably about an hour, they had it on paper what the cause of death was. And if anybody who's ever worked in law enforcement, you know, or anybody who does or has worked in law enforcement that's listening to this now, you might understand that it's actually normal for cases that are textbook suicides for them to take months to declare the cause of death, which was not at all the case in this situation.
Why is that common, and why wasn't that the case here?
So when I found this out, it was a few days until I hopped on a plane and met my aunt in Chicago, and we drove directly to the funeral home. When I got to the funeral home, the deputy of peace sat me down outside on a bench outside the funeral home and said, Brandon, I just want to let you know that there was a young girl who died while giving birth to a baby. When the medics showed up, rigor mortis had set in. The body was cleaned. The baby's body was cleaned. There were no signs of rags that were bloody, nothing. And there was no investigation. And Brandon, that's all I can tell you.
I think I heard about that in one of our other interviews, or Melody had mentioned that, but yeah.
But sadly, you know, with my mother's clinical issues, you know, her body was found in 2017, fully dressed, makeup, in bed, looking as beautiful as she could. She was a beautiful lady. And her suicide would illustrate a classic textbook suicide. And it took the authorities in Wisconsin 3 months to decide what the cause of death was. And in that case, in that jurisdiction, the authorities aren't really so concerned with the bureaucracies that are required for probate or estate law. They're concerned about the law and the actual circumstances. So in her case, there was no hurry to do it. And in, I guess in the case of, what would this be, Baird County, Callahan County, Taylor County, I'm not really sure. But they were lightning fast with that one. And I guess that's the only experience I've ever had bureaucratically in that part of the country where things were lightning fast.
I believe it's Callahan County. This just goes to what I've said before, Andrew, that us ex-members in general, a majority of us anyway, do believe there is some type of unspoken agreement or payoff going on in that county to where they look the other way when laws are broken, when people die, when there's abuse, when there's polygamy, all of these things that are illegal that they know are going on, they are turning a blind eye to it. They don't really want to deal with it. And I mean, they may be getting paid off. We all have suspicions. We don't have any proof, but certainly the behavior is not typical and seems suspicious at the least.
I would agree. Not even sure that's the correct statement. Brandon, your dad, what year was it when they found your dad?
2015.
And your mom?
My mother died in 2017.
2 years later. Did you speak? This is a silly question. You spoke to your mom after your father passed?
Mm-hmm.
What was her reaction?
She was sad. I spoke to her a couple times. My mother did her best to cope with difficult circumstances, despite that she did her best. It, you know, probably didn't come across that way to the rest of us children. But the last time I had spoken to her, she expressed that she did feel guilty about my father's death. You know,
she did.
Yeah, she did. I didn't think. I mean, I understood why she did, but I didn't feel like she was a part of it. I didn't blame her for it.
Kind of where I was going with that question is because she took her own life. Was that out of guilt, out of shame, remorse?
My mother suffered from depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder. She suffered tremendously from mental health issues. And, you know, for people in the family, it's still difficult for some of them to process and really understand. I spent more time with my mother than my other siblings, and so my relationship with her was a little bit different. But I think that propelled me to try to sort things out, you know, in the way that I did.
What year did you publish your book?
So technically, I guess right at the beginning of 2021, January of 2021. But I had written the content to most of it publicly on my blog, and that was in 2015. But yeah, 2021.
Any kickback? Is not the right word. Any retort from the House of Yahweh when?
So when I was blogging about it, and I went to bury my father. You know, I had a lot of snide remarks from some people there. You know, some of the higher level people. You know, they made it known that they were reading what I was writing.
Right. Okay. Wow.
The book is in Spanish now. It's soon going to be published in Spanish with a slightly different title.
Very interesting.
Did you want to say any more about your book, Brandon? I mean, at the very least, let's tell her. I mean, I'm going to say I read Brandon's book. It's been a few years, but it was, and I'm not a reader. I hate to admit that, but I'm going to admit it again. I'm not a big reader, and it actually was a very easy read. It's very captivating. And I'm going to say that, you know, it's intriguing even for some. Was more interesting, I'm sure, to me because I was a member of the House of Yahweh and I knew all these people he was talking about. And I guess I highly recommend the book. It was very interesting to read how Brandon goes through the process of showing how he deconstructed what he had learned from the House of Yahweh and reconstructed his life in such an articulate way that it's so easy to follow and you can relate to it very well.
Any chance there's an audio version?
When I get the time. I mean, I would like to. It's such an arduous process with platforms like Amazon. Amazon gives you the outreach. They're very specific, and then of course they take a significant cut. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I haven't been so motivated to do it. But no,
understandable. So where are you today? I don't mean geographically. We know you're in Portugal, but many years have passed. So the book was published in 21. It is now 2025. They introduced you with multiple credentials, or like she said, you're in acting now. Talk about some of the things that you're involved with.
I have worked as a voice actor for a few years, and that's a lot of fun. Primarily, I still work in education. I've worked in consulting and project management for a while. But since I wrote the book, you know, a lot of people from different sects have reached out to me and shared their experiences, and in a few cases, extremely brutal cases. And so that was something that I really didn't expect after writing the book, was to hear a lot about other people's trauma.
From other cults.
Yeah, from other cults. Also, maybe, you know, some from the House of Yahweh as well, but from other cults. And I had given many copies away. I think I probably gave about 300 copies away. And so a lot of these people, you know, within that group, a lot of people reached out to me and explained to me their situation. So I didn't expect that. And that took some processing. But with my work in education and consulting, it just kind of turned into coaching. And so in 2021, I guess I started getting into analytical psychology. And so now I use a lot of analytical psychology with my, you know, well-being coaching. I do a little bit of HR consulting as well. You know, I do have clients that have, you know, dealt with bereavement, grief, and or even, you know, drug addiction. You know, the book has some parts with substance abuse in it. So, you know, I didn't expect to go down that realm. And it's not that I'm trying to go out there and help people, but I just have this background and I used, essentially, you know, philosophy and life to, you know, live a life without resentment.
That's pretty amazing considering. So where are you in your deconstruction process? What phase?
To which phase of the deconstruction process? So, well, you know, in some areas of psychology, they talk about capital T trauma and lowercase t trauma, you know, trauma that's caused by a specific event or trauma that's created over time. You see, thankfully, within the first 5 years of my life, I didn't really have too much instability. I had enough stability to where my brain could develop in a healthy way. And, you know, everybody, you know, has areas of their psyche that are difficult to acknowledge and they're uncomfortable to acknowledge. Carl Jung referred to this as their shadow. People who grow up in an abusive environment and they get out of that abusive environment, if they say to themselves, I don't want to feel this way, I would like to feel joy, and then they study themselves, well, in Jungian terms, they're actually going into their shadow. They're really like kind of unveiling some uncomfortable truths about themselves, you know, and they're really discerning the truth of the matter within themselves. And so, you know, that right there is what people can do and what people often do without needing that much help. And depending on the individual will determine how much help they get from the people around them or how much help they find from other sources that are out there. So, other people, on the other hand, unfortunately, they might have a traumatic experience, a complex traumatic experience. Let's say like the concept could be institutional trauma. You know, they were part of a group, an institution, and that institution took advantage of them. And then they're, you know, they're too proud to acknowledge it. So they just want to forget it. They don't want to talk about it at all. And that runs a little bit of a risk because there's always going to be these triggers and things that can just pop up. And so
Did writing your book help you in any
way? Writing the book helped, but I was trying to do that work for years before I ever wrote the book. The content for the book was written in about 3 months. It poured out. It was a cathartic experience. But again, like the purpose of writing that book was a message to my parents, and the story was for my siblings. I wanted them to know what it was that I had gone through.
Amazing. I'm amazed at what you went through. And so where are you today? Are you married? You settled, traveled around Europe. You said Sweden, Germany, Spain, and you settled in Portugal. Is that you're staying there for now?
Yeah, no, I own a house here. You know, I enjoy the village life. I know I still play music. I work. I really like furniture design. I do leather work. So I have a few different business activities here with. I enjoy life. I mean,
wife, children.
No wife or kids yet. Hopefully in the future. I mean, that would be nice. But I mean, in terms of, you know, what I think what really makes most people happy is just good food and good people.
Agreed. Yeah.
One more thing, Brandon, before we wrap up, I'm going to assume that certainly some ex-House EOA members will be listening to our episode, but let's just say some current members that might be listening or maybe having some doubts. Do you have any words of advice or wisdom to anybody that might still be there that is starting to have a little bit of critical thinking kicking in? What would be your words of advice to them?
So I think probably one of the most important things that we can always agree on is that honesty is very important. And it's probably, you know, the most important value that healthy parents tell their children. And most parents probably have said, it's not about, you know, you lying to us. It's about you lying to yourself. That's the most important thing. You just can't lie to yourself. And when I was, I think maybe 14 or 15, I was trying to get my English teacher interested into the House of Yahweh. And he just said, you know, Brandon, if you really like this, if this is really what you believe in and really what you want to do, then you need to do this. And, you know, so the message would be that if you're sure that you want to be a part of this, if you're sure that this is the right thing for you to do in all of your being at every moment, then go ahead and do it. If that's truly what you believe, but you have to ask yourself that. And if there is doubt, then you have to look at that too and ask yourself, well, why is there the doubt? And, you know, the critical thinking part, as much as I value it and I emphasize and stress it with, you know, everybody that I interact with, when you're in an environment where, I mean, you know, in our case, you know, the greatest sin is to doubt the teaching of the House of Yahweh. It's really difficult to have critical thinking. I'm still baffled at, I'm just still, you know, maybe clueless as to how to get people to think critically. Not only in the house of Yahweh was it something that just wasn't allowed or entertained. It's just like, you know, today more than ever, it seems to be the case as well.
I think coming from, talked about substance abuse, and I'm in recovery from alcohol. So I'll use it as an analysis. You can only come to that conclusion that I'm an alcoholic or I'm in a cult. You have to, it's the denial, you know? You talked about being honest. Somebody who's in a cult, they have to be honest. Are they, like you said, are you truly happy where you are? You have to come to that conclusion by yourself. So to say to somebody, how to get somebody to think critically, it has to come from within. That's just my perspective. And not being an ex-cult member, but being addicted to something else for many years, I know that that had to come from within.
Well, deep down. It does. It's a very unusual process, though. But as an ex-cult member, I can honestly say that all cult members are 100% sure that they are not a part of a cult.
Yeah.
That is very true. And I will say that I remember the time that I experienced my biggest episode of cognitive dissonance was actually when I was at another member's house and they brought up this polygamy thing. And it was the first time I was hearing it. And my brain was trying to, and I just kept thinking, this can't be true. This can't be true. That's all my brain kept saying to me, because it was like the part of my brain had to protect the house of Yahweh and my religious belief at that time. And I just could not accept it as the reality, even though everything they were saying made sense. And so my brain, I just couldn't even process it. It was very, very, that was when I think the doubts first started creeping in, but I really did think that these were rumors and they had to be false and there wasn't truth to it. And I think that was the beginning of the end for me, really.
Brandon, personal question, and then we have to say goodbye. But I asked this of all of our guests. Where are you today with your faith?
Yeah. So at the end of my book, I do say that I am against organized religion. I do need to add to that because I do value the values in religion. And I do believe that there is something much deeper than what we see. I think that, you know, and this is something that I ask my clients when my clients tell me that they're religious. I say, well, how do you define God? And, you know, even if they say they're atheists, well, how do you define God? How do you define what you don't believe in? Because I can easily see, like, okay, if you think God is a man in the clouds, you know, like you don't believe in that, that's fine. If that's what you think that all the Christians believe in, you don't believe in that, then that's fine. So I do believe in a higher being. I certainly do. But I think that every individual needs to go through the linguistical process of being able to define that. Because in most cases, and perhaps for yourself, but in most cases, when somebody is asked to define God, whether they believe in God or not, they don't have a definition.
No.
Yeah. And you can have one, but it's going through this linguistical process to decide for yourself what that is. And once people do, then I think it's much easier to find yourself in these, like, you know, religious environments or, you know, have discussions about God or whatever it is, because then you have your own definition. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. No, and I agree 100% because that's where I'm at. I believe in a higher power, but I'm not so sure that I'm going to put a three-letter word, God, in between there or at the end or the beginning.
Sure. But I do want to say one thing, though, to any, you know, any current House of Yahweh members, ex-members, other extreme religious groups. There are so many people out there who are willing to help you and talk to you and love you and care about you. The people in the House of Yahweh, 95% of those people have and always will be wonderful, excellent people. And the people who've left, we still stay in contact. We still share joy with each other. And we went to the House of Yahweh to share joy with each other, and we still share joy with each other today, and we are always, always willing to help each other out still. I made a phone call a couple weeks ago because I needed help with something, and I talked to somebody that I hadn't talked to for, I don't know, 5 or so years, and I only talked to him once since we both left, and he was more than willing to help me out with something. And that's just It's just a normal thing. So, you know, anybody who's considering, you know, leaving the house of Yahweh, yeah, that's great. Ultimately, we just want you to be healthy and safe emotionally, spiritually, physically. And that despite the fact that we are not a part of the house of Yahweh and essentially have, you know, no respect for that institution, we still care about everybody there. And we have maintained a very loving community outside of it.
I love that. Ahead, I love that, Brandon, because there's so much truth to it. I've always envisioned us as ex-House of Yahweh members getting together and having an anti-feast or something just to get together because we all are bonded by our experience, whether it's trauma bonding or not. We are bonded by that experience because it's unique.
It's not trauma bonding.
Nobody can understand it the way that we do, right?
Absolutely.
What'd you say, Brandon? It's not trauma bonding?
It's not trauma bonding. Trauma bonding is when somebody, I mean, don't get me wrong, trauma bonding could happen, but trauma bonding is when, you know, generally two individuals, usually that don't know each other, and they only know each other through a relational experience that involves trauma. And this usually happens as they're coming out. And then so the emotions that are shared within that experience of coming out of their trauma, getting through their trauma, it causes them to form a bond. And that bond is generally a bond that's only, strong.
That's the common denominator that they have. Yeah.
Well, as they continue to develop and get out of their trauma, they don't have that. So, but yeah, we do have a bond. And with my experience talking with ex-members, we're not, you know, reminiscing about the bad times. Sometimes we talk about the good times, but we're just talking about what we're doing now, what's going on. And then for the most part, everybody's just, you know, very thankful that, you know, our lives are doing pretty good. And as far as I know, for most people that have left, I mean, their lives are really good. They've moved on.
Yeah.
And that's all you can hope for everybody.
Brandon, thank you so much for joining us today. Just an amazing story. And Kudos to you. Yeah, go ahead, Melody.
Oh, I know that Brandon has a really busy schedule and we had to do some juggling around and we got some dates mixed up. But I'm so, so glad we made this happen because I really did want you to come on.
Thank you
and
so
I appreciate
much,
you making the time.
No, everybody's put in a lot of effort here. So thank you guys.
Yeah. All right, Brandon, be safe, be well, and stay happy.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. And Andrew and I just want to thank Brandon so much for coming on the show and sharing his story and his experience. I know the one thing that we didn't mention, I think he did kind of touch on it slightly, but you can find his book on Amazon. And that link will be in the show notes. The title of his book is Poison into Medicine, subtitle My Life in a Doomsday Cult by Brandon W. Salo. And we will have a link to his book in the show notes as well. But an articulate young man. I call him a young man because I still think of him as young because he was 11 years old when I left, right? So he was still a child, but he's just grown into such an articulate, well-rounded, multi-talented young man. I almost feel parental toward him. So I'm just so proud of him.
Yeah. And of course, this is the first time I met him, but my first impression of him was everything you just said, very talented, articulate. I really enjoyed the conversation. And as I said in the actual episode, I did not squirm on this one, but he did have a disturbing story.
Yes. Yes. Lots of, I would say trauma is a good word for it. Lots of loss and lots of trauma.
Two parents to suicide?
Within two years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Within 2 years.
Yeah.
And as bad as that was, the parents splitting at the age 5, and he seems to have a very good recollection of that. Like when I go back to think when I was 5, I struggle. Like I remember pedaling down a sidewalk on a tricycle, and I don't even know where, you know, but that's how far back my memory can. His was like very, he knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And he even said something about at 3 years old, he knew his mother was a narcissist.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he had at least figured out that something wasn't quite right. Yeah. He
right. Was right. Yeah.
Aware enough to put that together at quite a young age, which that in itself is very impressive. The only other thing I want to touch on, which is kind of switching the subject here a little bit, actually a lot, but is again the suspicion of the deaths and the loss in the house of Yahweh, and just not the somehow the law enforcement in that area just basically turning a blind eye to it, because I know that there is, and I don't don't remember the name of the gentleman, but there is actually a more recent death in the house of Yahweh that actually was another death that was under very suspicious circumstances that they were calling a suicide, but that the evidence showed something different. And his wife has been all over the internet basically saying that there's something wrong here. This was not properly investigated. And I don't think he died of a suicide. And so this is not the first time this is happening. And I don't know if there's something going on there where they're starting to, I don't know. I'm going to use the word, and I use this lightly. I don't know if it doesn't sound lightly, but almost eliminating people that are maybe going to be a potential problem, or if they have some kind of, because this is another thing that I haven't talked about yet about the House of Yahweh, Andrew, too. And I'm going to do this in some of my videos, but they now have a practice where all the members have signed over wills that when they die, everything goes to the House of Yahweh. Everything they own, all of their assets. I mean, and I believe Brandon's father was one of these people that had done that. And so, you know, is this sometimes they're eliminating members for financial gain? I don't know this, but it certainly seems suspicious. And there's certainly some speculation there that something nefarious is going on, and the law enforcement just is not properly investigating these suspicious deaths.
It's going to take a whistleblower from within to expose yes. this if it's in fact happening, and if in fact it ever will come to light, it will have to come from deep within.
Yes. And I was so glad that he touched on that in his book too, because he goes into a lot of detail about more why this is the suspicious circumstances of his father's death and how it was handled and how he was treated when he went down there. And it's just, there's so much intertwined in there and everybody has their own tragic story, right? We come out and, you know, like we've interviewed multiple people from the Jehovah's Witnesses, and they all have their own different story. And the same is true, obviously, of every cult, and the House of Yahweh is not unique to that. Brandon's got his own unique trauma that he had to deal with while in there and after he left.
And again, not sure when this is going to air, but Melody, to the audience, Melody has been producing short videos on, is it TikTok or Instagram or both?
I'm first recording them on TikTok, but I stopped putting them on Instagram for a while because they only do 3 minutes, but now I've started putting them back on Instagram and just putting for the full episode, for the full version of the video, you can either find it on the Cultimatum podcast Facebook page or the Cultimatum TikTok account. So either one of those, you can find the full video. So I'm still putting them on there because they were getting a lot of hits. And I'm just like, I at one point had posted a video saying I'm not going to post these here anymore, but I changed my mind and decided that I think I should, and just because they are getting enough views with the first 3 minutes that, and if anybody wants to see the full version, they know where they can go. But yes, I'm doing a deeper dive into the House of Yahweh, and Andrew and I are talking. Andrew's going to watch and go through some of those, and we're probably going to do some type of bonus episode where Andrew can ask questions, and we'll do an even deeper dive into the deeper dive.
So if you're listening, if anybody in the audience is listening and you're from the House of Yahweh or member or just interested in the House of Yahweh altogether, we're going to do a much deeper dive into this cult. And yes, I said cult.
Yes. So if you want to come on and share your story, we'll go into that. I'll let Andrew cover that. But first of all, I'm just going to once again thank Brandon for coming on the show and making time in his schedule for us. We greatly appreciate it. And we also want to thank all of you for tuning into Cultimatum. As always, your support is greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify. On Spotify, you can also leave individual comments on individual episodes. And on Apple, you can write a review along with also giving like a 5 or 4 star, whatever you think we deserve, review. I would hope it would be at least 4 stars. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our episodes.
Five stars. Number 5. You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member in search of any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
And you can check out my other podcast, which at the time of this recording may have a new name, but it is a podcast about modern romance. So I'm not going to give you the name because right now it's called the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast, but I'm in the middle of rebranding. So by the time you hear this, it may have a new name. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can show your support through Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in our show notes. Every bit helps in our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.